Welcome to After the End from the Ethos Centre at the University of Oxford, funded by the Wellcome Discovery Awards Scheme. I'm Patricia Kingori, Professor of Global Health Ethics at the University of Oxford. In this series, we explore endings and their aftermaths. Who decides when an end has been reached? Whether the end for one person is the end for everybody? And what happens after these so-called endings? Today, I'm with jellyfish fan Miranda Lowe, theoretical physicist Felix Flicker, and performance artist and zombie Martin O'Brien for a discussion on time, mortality, and immortality.
I'm Martin O'Brien. I'm a performance artist, and I was talking about some of the work that I've been making and thinking about the idea and possibilities of the undead. And I guess I've been thinking about endings since I was a child, obsessed with endings as in mortality, the end of life and consciousness. But I'm really interested in the possibilities of practices that might go beyond an ending. And I thought about this idea of zombie time as a kind of temporal experience of living on when the end was supposed to have happened. Like, what happens when you live longer than expected? The end is somehow behind you and you inhabit a different kind of relationship to the end. And what are the kind of political possibilities of living with ending or with death as part of your body and part of your life? I was thrilled to hear that there's this creature that's immortal, the immortal jellyfish. Kind of blows my mind. But also in your work, Miranda, the possibility of preservation, which was really exciting for me, and the display of the dead, but a kind of immortality that's not based on life necessarily, but the preservation of this body.
Miranda Lowe, Principal Curator at the Natural History Museum in London. What springs to mind when you say that, Martin, is also the phrase life after death. It's also that the way I work and the job that I do is essentially within preservation techniques so that work can be done around those dead things that reside in the museum to give a life to the same organisms that are still living in the deep dark ocean or will lend themselves biomedically and through their chemistry or their life cycle to us as human beings, essentially. Until now, I haven't really appreciated that I'm working in a place similar to a morgue. But I also realised, Martin, that we are both working within deathly practices, as you phrased it. So a lot of the work that I'm doing, I'm looking down a microscope at dead things and trying to understand the way that they lived. My research is then impacting those living organisms in terms of the protection of those animals for future generations so that things can still be seen in their environment in a living way.
I'm Felix Flicker. I'm a senior lecturer in physics at Bristol University. I gave a talk where I presented some things that we're confident about in physics, ideas from special relativity, and then some, frankly, rather speculative things I've thought about as a theoretical physicist. So I have a better answer to a question that Martin asked me earlier. So you're asking, how do we perceive the end, or what?
How does your work shape our understanding of endings? And now that we've had these discussions, how do you now perceive ideas around endings?
As a result of these excellent talks that I got to sit through, I've had a bit of a think about this. It reminded me of an interview question that a friend of mine was asked when they interviewed many years ago here in Oxford. They said, okay, imagine you step into some machine that scans all the atoms in your body, and then it sends that information somewhere else, like a teleporter out of Star Trek or something. And it sends all the information to another machine that can assemble all the same atoms in the same places. And then it disintegrates the original version of you, and this new version of you comes into existence at the same instant. Is that really you, the new one? Because they're different atoms, but they're all the same carbon atoms or whatever and that kind of thing. I think most people answered this, and I think my friend answered this by saying, yeah, I think it's you, because there would be no sort of break in your understanding of the world. It's like walking through a door, in a sense. You feel like you've walked through one door and you've walked out of another door, but there's no discontinuity. But then the interviewer asked them, okay, so you think that's still you that comes out of the other end of the machine. But now say the machine breaks and it scans all the original things, sends the information, creates the new copy, but it forgets to delete the original. Now, which of the two versions of you is really you? Because if you said that the one down on the planet in that scenario is you, then what about the one where you literally just stood there and got scanned? Surely that's still you. And I think this was an interview for like law, for like jurisprudence. And I think they said, so who gets access to the bank account was the ultimate question. So the jellyfish made me think all about this, because the jellyfish, some of them can clone themselves. And then is the clone the original? I mean, got certainly continuity. But then also it can do a different thing where it goes from this Medusa phase, a fully grown one, to a sort of polyp, I think you called it, and then back again. And so which one of them is the original? I think a consistent answer, but maybe not a fully satisfying one, is you could say that, well, actually, neither of the copies of the person are the original, because in both cases, they would answer a question differently to the person who stepped into the machine. You could ask them all, have you stepped into this machine and stepped out of this same machine? And all three would answer differently. The person who hasn't stepped into the machine would give one answer, I've not been in. The person who steps out on the planet would give a different answer, I stepped in and stepped out on the planet. And the other one who stepped into the machine and stayed in the machine would give a third answer. So you could say a consistent answer would be to say that none of them are the original. And then if you think of it that way, you never really die, because you only ever exist in one instant, because the person who'd answer differently an instant later has had a different experience, and by that definition is a different person. So you always kind of live in an instant. And this is kind of relating to the much less speculative thing I was saying about physics, which is that when you analyze what you're doing with your calculations, you always refer to these instants and events, as we call them, so space-time events. And you really want to think of things as broken down into these separate events. And I was asking whether they're really connected up. So that was the thing that you made me think of with the jellyfish.
And that was the conversation I was trying to remember.
So this really directly relates to the questions around ends and ending, because if you don't die, then you don't end. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. Hmm. Either you sort of live forever, but only ever in an instant, and the person who lives in the next instant is a different person. I like thinking of it like that. So in a sense, you're sort of immortal and there is no end, because there is only change rather than time, I suppose.
I think what's really emerging for me that's really interesting is that we've had for a really long time, but especially in the 20th century, this seeing the end as this motivating force. We've had it a lot in religious aspects, the ends being very important to motivate us to do certain things. So that the end in of itself is this instrumental function that allows certain things to happen. It allows the way we think about the allocation of resources. It allows the way we prioritize and the way we think about what is of value and what isn't of value. So thinking with all of your work, how does this then shape the way we think about resources, about priorities, if we trouble and question endings?
I think one really clear answer is around health and healthcare. And from my own situation of being born with cystic fibrosis and first not really being expected to live beyond childhood, and then the kind of average life expectancy being 30, not being expected to live beyond that. And if you think about it, spread across the population of people with cystic fibrosis, there's a whole group of us who are now aging, who never expected to age, growing old together. So there's something around resources there and healthcare and being in the UK with the NHS and the fight to keep national health going in order to keep people alive. But then what's the financial cost of us people with CF and other life-shortening diseases living into adulthood, living into older age? And there's implication there around health for everybody and for the whole country and the ways in which we can maintain health services. And as medical research helps us live longer and delays endings of sorts, then what are the implications on our ability to maintain those structures that are so important to us? It's not an answer, but I guess it opens up more questions around health and survival as well, not just for the sick, people who were born sick, but for all of us as a species.
It seems like a really simple idea that ends don't really exist. But when we've had a whole society and a whole economy that's structured really clearly around ends, then this really simple question pulls at the strings of so many institutions and ways of thinking. I'm really interested in how this question lands with you.
My take on it would be, I'm very concerned about the climate crisis, as I imagine most people are. And I've been really thinking there's a good chance that we won't make it through the 21st century. By the end of my lifetime, probably, the disaster will have happened. I realized at some point that that's not really true. In a sense, it will be. We don't take action. You know, things will be substantially transformed. But it won't actually be the end of the world. People will survive in some way. And we always feel like it's the end of the world, don't we? Look at culture from the 80s. They're all obsessed with the fact that they're going to end in a nuclear war at any moment. And as soon as that was gone, the ozone was a problem. And that was going to cause the end of the world. And now it's the climate crisis. And I thought, do humans just perpetually live in this sense that the world is about to end? And it's always about the same period of time in the future. I think the climate crisis is absolutely real, but perhaps it was unhelpful to think, oh, it's sort of all or nothing. It's more like a lot of people are going to be very badly affected by it. Things won't all stop. We'll have to keep working through that. So perhaps it's better to think of it in those terms. If I might tie it to what I work on, because the specific form of physics I work on is matter, lumps of stuff. Traditionally, when you think of science, you think of a Victorian gentleman who has an experiment and isolates it from the rest of the world. And that's the basic idea you're taught of science, is I take this thing and it's separate from everything else, and then I can control it scientifically. But I think that's really outdated. And my branch of physics embraces the idea that that's the past, I think, because matter is a collective behavior. So a lump of stuff, I don't know, a crystal or something, is made of atoms, but you can't think of it as individual atoms. The important thing is how it behaves collectively. So you're no longer trying to isolate things and say, oh, I'm trying to work out the fundamental basics of reality in the sense of its separate particles, because something more emerges when you put those things together. And the simple analogy we always give is consciousness. A person is a load of atoms, and that's true. As a materialist, I believe we are just a bunch of atoms, but I also believe we have a consciousness, and then we're more than a bunch of atoms at the same time. With the environment, I think this is kind of relevant, because that outdated view of science treats things in isolation is also the view where you say, well, I need some electricity, so I go and get some stuff out of the ground, and you ignore the consequences of that, and you forget that you live in the environment and you're part of it. I think we're coming ground in science as it develops to saying, well, we're not isolated, we're part of those systems, we are part of the environment. And the sort of type of science I do has to face up to that fact that you can't isolate things, that there are collective behaviours that are important in their own right.
And I think this idea about not isolating things, even endings, from other things, it's really an interesting juncture, because on the one hand, it's really important we take endings seriously, because as we said, they mobilise people to do things, they focus our attention on certain things. But part of the aim of the After the End project is to also question what happens after. And if we only look at the ending, we make no mitigations for existing after those, in the same way that you were describing, Martin. If we only take 30, you make no allowance for what happens for the people who live after them. We've seen that in multiple conditions as well. So I thought that insight was really important. One of the questions I wanted to ask, actually, Miranda, you mentioned something in your talk I wanted to open up to both Martin and Felix. You mentioned how difficult it is to study something that's immortal, and that we don't have an infrastructure to study things that will potentially go on forever. And that in of itself, I thought was so interesting, because it highlighted the sort of lack of our imagination and the lack of our own ability to think about duration and to put infrastructure in place around duration. And you used the jellyfish community. I didn't even know if there was one, but I'm glad to have been introduced to one of its members. Around this idea of how do you study longevity and how do you take that seriously?
Well, it's a big problem, and it's even closer now, because the person who has taken on board for the last 30 years to study, interestingly, in isolation, the immortal jellyfish, is now going to retire from his research. So where does that leave us all, other than starting again with a new research group? And this is the issue around funding in the scientific community, or projects having a beginning and an end. The research on something like the immortal jellyfish has no end. So how do you factor that in, or change the criteria around funding for something to be funded eternally? And it's not just about the funding, it's about having those people that have the skills to study as well. So in my world, we suffer from the lack of taxonomists. So those are people that name things in science, that know how to identify them, know how to look at the organs or the structure of an animal. It's the same as doctors or specialists in certain parts of human anatomy and diseases and illnesses. So the push not only to fund a research topic, but in the first place to have those individuals that are trained and have that skill set and that are valued enough also to continue this work. Because a lot of it within my world, natural history, zoology, it's all about the passion to study things, not necessarily about the pay that you get. It's about, for me, the curiosity, the understanding. Felix, you mentioned about scientists studying things in isolation. Yes, that's what they did that in Victorian times, but more and more, because of the environmental and climate crisis, you have to look at things holistically and as ecosystems, how animals, plants, us as human beings within whatever you consider to be the natural world, but on this planet, how we interact, be aware of our impact, and to be aware of where there are impacts on other things globally, not just where you're sitting or standing now, and in terms of space, not just outer space, but in the deep, dark oceans as well. So putting all that information together gives us a bigger picture and an understanding and how we respond to certain things, that it's not just in isolation. We shouldn't be selfish as human beings. We should be looking more into communities, how we are within our community and how we look at things ecologically and environmentally. So for me, even though I work essentially with dead things, I collaborate with researchers that are looking into ecosystems and animals and plants that are currently living. It's never one thing in isolation, and it's about valuing everything and understanding where, if something is knocked out of that situation, what's going to be the impact and the cost to society.
Martin made a really good point earlier. You said that there's been these developments with the drugs, and therefore you said you were a bit like the jellyfish. I thought that was amazing.
Yeah, I'd always wanted to compare myself to the Greenland shark before, because I'm a shark obsessive, but now the jellyfish, the immortal jellyfish. So over the last 10 years, there's been a lot of new medication coming out for people with cystic fibrosis. And now I've started this drug over the last 5 years, which has actually transformed my life. And for most people with cystic fibrosis, it's been really transformational. But one of the side effects of this, which really relates to what you were saying, Miranda, where you talked about the impossibility of studying immortality, or at least the difficulty of it, this new drug that I'm taking, who knows what it's going to do in terms of longevity for people with cystic fibrosis, how long I'm going to live, I have no idea now. I could live to be a very, very old person now. I could live into old age, which seemed impossible a few years ago even. So it brings up these questions about what is the legacy of this, and what's the kind of possibility of longevity, and how is that studied? There can't be a full study of this new drug, I guess, until they've seen through the life cycle of people like me, who are the first generation to start taking that. How do you understand that? How do you figure that out? How do you study it like the immortal jellyfish? How do you keep the sort of legacy of that study going over generations and generations?
That brings us to the end of this podcast. Thank you for listening. Do join us next time when we hear from Daniel Carroll, Western University, Canada, on Indigenous Peoples' Time and Climate Change. I'm Patricia King-Ori, and you've been listening to After the End, brought to you by the Ethos Centre at the University of Oxford, funded by the Wellcome Discovery Awards Scheme. Please share this episode on and subscribe to the series wherever you get your podcasts. You can find more information about the After the End project on our website at www.afterTheEnd.squarespace.com.